Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Dr. Simon talking to you from, again, sunny Florida. We've had pouring rains here today, and this is the wet season, and it's been the driest season in all the years I've been here in Florida, so I was relieved to see some water coming from the sky. Not as much relief as I think they would feel in Oregon, Washington, and California to see some water falling out of the sky. But it's sunny again, and my show is called The Stories We Live By. And today, I have the absolute pleasure of joining in conversation with a colleague and a friend. When did we first meet? This is Dr. Al Galves, who's going to come on. He's a psychologist and psychotherapist who lives in Las Cruces, New Mexico. When did we first meet? It was 2003, 2004?
Yeah, you know, when we first met, and I tell you the story. I knew about Peter Breggin, Larry, and I knew I wanted to fight biopsychiatry. I knew that this is bad stuff, and I got to fight this. And I knew about Peter Breggin, so I called the number that I had, and Ginger answered. And I talked to Ginger. I said, Ginger, how can I get involved in this? She said, Al, there's going to be a conference over in New Jersey in October. Here's what you do. Call Larry Simon or Dominic Riccio. You call them up and find out how you can get over there. And get
what
to the
year
conference.
Was that?
2003 or 2004.
It was three. Yeah,
yeah.
I did the conference for 2003 and 2004.
Yeah, okay, so I called you, and that's what happened. I called you and said, well, here's what you do. And so I went to the conference, and that's how we met, yeah.
Yeah. And what I'm impressed about in your work is not merely that you're a psychotherapist, and I know you have to be a very good one because you believe in democracy and being kind and being attentive and not putting people down, and you know that the idea of mental illness is bullshit. But you've done a lot of work with what's called the survivors, psychiatric survivors. That is, not people who have survived mental illness, but have survived psychiatry. Give us a little rundown on that.
Yeah, well, for many years, since 2004, I've been on the board of directors of Mind Freedom International. And Mind Freedom International was started by David Oakes and Janet Foner. Both David and Janet had been hospitalized and forcibly treated. They'd had the symptoms of so-called schizophrenia or psychosis, so-called, and they had been hospitalized and forcibly drugged. And David, when he was in the hospital, they gave him Haldol. They shot him with Haldol, and it had such a bad reaction to him. He said, no more. Don't give me that stuff anymore. And so they put him in seclusion. And so he decided then, I'm going to spend my life fighting this bullshit. And so that organization, Larry, basically fights forced treatment, all kinds of forced treatment. And they do it by, they have a Mind Freedom Shield, which is a solidarity network of people who are at risk of being hospitalized against their will. And the deal is they notify everybody, and everybody then calls the governor, the hospital administrator, the psychiatrist, and just raise hell about it. They have demonstrations at the American Psychiatric Association, opposing biopsychiatry. And they also promote alternatives, you know, like Soteria House and Open Dialogue and intentional peer support and crisis respite centers all those kinds of alternatives. So they answer the question, look, if you don't like drugs, you don't like forced treatment, what do you like? So that's Mind Freedom. And then I've also gotten involved
with
the Hearing Voices
now,
Network.
People who hear this are going to want to know, and people, by the way, I don't have a lot of people who hear these shows, but what happens over time, a lot of people download this stuff, and it goes out all over the world. I have people who follow this show on every continent, although lately nobody in South America. If they wanted to get involved or they wanted to call and make contact with Mind Freedom, mindfreedom.org or mindfreedom.com? Where, how would they
it's
do
mindfreedom.org.
That?
It's mindfreedom.org. It's www.mindfreedom.org.
Okay. Very
and
good.
The number, I'll give you the phone number.
Well,
for the,
you know what?
Go ahead.
Email me the phone number, and I'll mention, I'll do a show and put it out in print.
Okay.
Because
okay, that
if anybody who hears this doesn't have a pencil, it's done. I mean, I know that.
Yeah.
So you'll email me, and I'll put it out.
Okay, so that's a great organization, mindfreedom.org. And,
now, you mentioned voice hearers. I hadn't heard of that until recently, but I got very excited by the idea that apparently people will hear voices, and some of them like it, and some of them don't like it, and some of them can control it, and some of them can't. And a lot of them seem to have now organized into groups.
Oh, yeah. There's something called the Hearing Voices Network. There's Hearing Voices USA. Let me tell you a little bit about the history.
Please.
The
this
history
is great
is stuff. That, interesting history. It started in the Netherlands, a psychiatrist named Marius Rome, right? And he's got a patient. He's working with a patient who's been diagnosed with schizophrenia. And the patient says to him one day, she says, you know, I don't get it. You people go to church and you pray to a God you don't see, you've never seen. You pray to this God and to spirits that you've never seen, and that's fine. And I listen to voices that I haven't seen, and you think I'm sick. I don't get it. And this guy listened, and he said, you know, you got a point there. And so he started talking to people, and he started meeting with people who were hearing voices and trying to understand what they were about, what was going on with people. So for somehow or other, it went over to the United Kingdom, and the United Kingdom went big time with hearing voices groups. So if you go onto the Internet and go to Hearing Voices Network, United Kingdom, you'll see what's going on in the United Kingdom. It's going on for a long time.
Yeah, I just put voice hearers into Google. I Googled it.
Okay.
And apparently there are now organizations all over.
Yeah, well, like, for instance, I run a Hearing Voices group here in Las Cruces, and it's actually on Zoom, so we have people from Colorado and from Houston in the group, and we meet once a week. And here's the deal. Here's what the Hearing Voices group is. It's a group where people who hear voices or have visions or unusual thoughts, unusual beliefs, where they can meet and they just share their experience. And they learn from each other, and it's totally not pathologized. This is not an illness. This is just something that's going on in your life, and let's see if we can help you understand.
Al,
what
it's
these
not
voices
an illness.
Are there for.
It's
right?
A psychological phenomena. That's
exactly.
All it is.
Yeah, and it's about their lives, and so what people learn how to do, they learn how to engage with the voices, and manage the voices, and. Learn what they're about. What are you doing here? What can I do to help you? You know, and so that's the whole idea of it, is to see these voices, hearing voices, as just something that's going on for some reason or other, probably has some meaning in the person's life, some reason for it, and learn from it. And
you see, for me, the interesting thing is I never heard of once in a while, I have to have something to drink. I might hear my name being Larry.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. And I know it's not, you know, and it only happens
right.
Under certain circumstances. And it never alarmed me. But I never understood that. I can't make a voice happen. Now, when I listen, people would tell me when I was working in the clinic for 25 years, my clinic became the outpatient refuge for people from Creedmoor Mental Hospital. This was during the deinstitutionalization during the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And I fell
mm-hmm,
in love
yeah.
with most of the people that I work with. And I remember once saying to a woman I worked with for 10 years early on, there are no voices. I said, the voices aren't real. And she said, the voices just said, you are not real. I thought that was so fabulous, but I don't understand it as a phenomenon. And I've been putting out questions on the internet. When a person hears a voice, do they hear it as if it's actually a voice in the room with them? Or do they know there's a difference between the sound of that? Right? Now, this particular person, when I would go on vacation, I would come back and she's in the hospital, because what we had worked out is that the voices sounded vaguely like a radio. So we talked about it, and I suggested, can you find the knob and turn the volume down? And when the voices were telling her she was an immortal poetess, she turned the volume up. When the voices told her she was the worst person on earth, she turned the volume down. When I went away on vacation, she turned it way up and ended up in the hospital because she would panic herself. Right? Yeah, so I came back from vacation. But to me, what a phenomenally interesting capacity.
Right.
But I don't understand. Right. Now, from your experience, when a person says they hear voices, do they treat it the same way as your voice when you're talking directly to them?
They experience it as a voice that isn't them, and it's real. It's real. And one of the principles of the Hearing Voices Network, they have a charter, you know, with the principles, is that the voices are real. And, so they experience it as a real voice, and it's not
them. No, they hear it.
It's a voice.
No, they actually hear it. But do they hear it the same as if you were talking to them and there was a voice at the same time?
Yes. That's how they hear
it. They do.
At least from what they say. Yeah. They hear it. Now, you know, people have different experiences in learning about what they are. For instance, I've heard people. Okay, I've listened to a person named Ron Coleman, who you can look this guy up. He's heard voices since he was like 15 years old. And one of the voices he heard was somebody, was sort of a voice that was telling him, you're a guilty person, you caused your own problems. And he finally came to realize that it was the voice of a priest who had abused him sexually when he was an altar boy.
Ah.
Right?
Yes.
See, and then, and one of the things that happens is once they realize, once they understand the meaning of the voice, and what it is and what it's there for, a lot of times the voice goes away.
Right.
And they can also...
But that's the central issue. It's a meaningful experience.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know,
and
in America, 97% of people want to hear the voice of God. And if they hear the voice of God, they're schizophrenic.
Right. Well, you know, how did Joseph Smith, you know, the prophet, the Mormon prophet, how did he stay out of the hospital? I just talked to the Archangel Michael, I just talked to Jesus. You know, well, because he was a high-status guy, and a lot of people who loved him.
Right.
So, yes, the whole idea is, and one of the big problems that these poor people have, if they go to a psychiatrist and they tell the psychiatrist that they're hearing voices, the psychiatrist isn't interested in the voices. The psychiatrist doesn't ask him, oh, really, what is the voice saying?
It's simply a symptom of an illness.
Exactly.
And into the hospital and popped on drugs.
Right.
Or
that's
ECT.
They just start writing the prescription.
Yes.
They aren't interested in the voices, what the voices are saying.
Well, let me ask you this. How many of our colleagues, because there was a time early in my career, if somebody had said they hear voices, I would have immediately gone to a supervisor or to the staff psychiatrist and reported it there. It was only after I started working with individuals that I realized how absolutely important and meaningful the experience was. And it was an externalization somehow of a conversation that they were having. And all of our consciousness experiences are conversations. But we know we're having the conversation internally. What happens with this now, somehow it gets turned on and it becomes an actual auditory or visual experience.
Right.
But it doesn't change the meaning of it in terms of its content, in terms of the function it has. This is all
exactly.
great. You wanted to talk about some other stuff, though, and I'd like to get to that.
Yeah. Okay, good.
So let's go. What do we go? Where are we now, Al?
Okay, here's my main message I had, the main concern. One of the big problems in this country is that people don't understand what quote unquote mental illness is, or you know the way I put it, people don't understand the nature of the states of being and the behaviors that people experience that lead them to be diagnosed.
Right.
They don't understand what they are. So I'll give you a couple of examples of how I know this. About 15 years ago, I read an article. It was about college students. And the article said that college students, when they're feeling agitated or down or, debilitated, angry, panicky, manic, very upset, they don't know if they're just reacting to their life situation or reacting to their life or if they have a mental illness, right?
As if
those are two different things. As if those aren't two different things. Those
totally
are one
different.
And the same thing.
Right.
Right? Yeah, so but this is what's happened. They've been bombarded with this message from the drug companies and advertising. This is a chemical imbalance, a brain disorder, genetic anomaly.
Al, and the rest of us.
And the rest
of
us.
Who goes into psychotherapy today and does not get diagnosed if they want health insurance to pay part of the fee?
Right. And the diagnosing is a problem. That's a big, but the big problem is that these college kids and people in that age cohort and most Americans, they don't realize that all so-called mental illnesses, all of them, everything from the mildest depression or anxiety to psychosis, they all are reactions. They're all how people are reacting to their lives and their life situations and concerns they have about themselves and their lives. That's what they are. But Americans believe there's something more than that. You see, there's something, somehow they're more in a mysterious way. They're more than just how people are reacting to their lives. And that's a big problem. So here's another example of how I know this. So this is about 5 years ago. I interviewed 10 people. And some of them were my friends. And I had a sign up at a coffee house, interviews on mental health. And I interviewed about 10 people. I asked them all, I say, what do you think causes mental illness? And they all gave me some kind of physiological answer, right?
Right.
A chemical imbalance, brain disorder, genetic problems. So then I ask him, well, what do you think triggered the change in the brains or the chemistry or the genetics? What do you think triggered it? Because the person wasn't mentally ill, and then they are. What do you think happened? And they all said, oh, something happened to the person. So I said, well, wait a second. Now you're telling me that the cause of this so-called mental illness is something happened to the person. But you just said before that it was a physiological thing. What's going on here? And they all were nonplussed, Larry. They all were surprised. They say, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So then I asked them the final question, right? Okay, so tell me this. Do you think there's a difference between how a person is reacting to his or her life situation and their life and concerns about themselves and their lives? Is there a difference between that and a diagnosable mental illness? And they all said yes. They all said yes. In other words, this is ridiculous. So they're confused. They don't know. And this is a big problem because if you believe that so-called mental illnesses, these states of being and behaviors, it can be troubling and painful and bizarre and upsetting, all of that. If you believe that they don't have anything to do with your life, you know, that there's something other than your life, then you're likely to go to drugs.
Right.
Or some kind of electric shock. But if you believe, oh, this is about my life, this is, what's going on and my difficulty coping, and then they're more likely to go to psychotherapy. So let me say a few more words about it, okay, Larry?
Yeah, because then I want to finish up.
A few more words.
The word coping, and I want to come back to the word coping when you finish. Go ahead.
Yeah, right, okay. So somebody asked Freud, apparently, when he was in his 80s. I said, "So, Dr. Freud, what's the key to mental health?" And he said, "The key to mental health is the capacity to love and the capacity to work."
Right.
Okay? Not to be loved and not to have people work, the capacity to love and the capacity to work. Now, a guy named Matthew Fox, who's a cleric, he took the word work and he said, "I'm going to change work to express oneself so that it's a broader concept." So he would say that the key to mental health, the key to being happy, if you will, is the capacity to love and the capacity to express oneself. So now you have the positive psychologists that you know about, Martin Seligman and those people.
Right.
And they study what are the ingredients of happiness, right? And they come up with this. The ingredients of happiness are using the best part of oneself in the interest of something bigger than oneself. That's number one. The second thing is positive relationships. And the third is achievement, mastery, and competence. Very similar to Freud's answer. So
right.
Here's the deal. For most human beings, what's important to them is being able to be connected with other human beings, to be able to love human beings in all kinds of ways. You know, romantic love, sexual love, family love, collegial love, all kinds of love, and to be able to use their abilities in satisfying ways, express themselves. Well, check it out. If people can't do that, if human beings cannot do that, and if they're afraid they'll never be able to do it and have no hope that they'll ever be able to do it, they get very
right.
upset. They get extremely
right.
upset. They get depressed and agitated
right.
and obsessed and manic
right.
and panic
right.
and psychotic.
Right.
And that's what's happening.
But you see, here's where I have to disagree with you.
Right.
I'm
okay.
totally with you up until this last section.
Right.
What is the mental illness is the coping itself.
Well, yes. Yes, because, yes,
so,
the mental illness
now,
can
the question
be the coping
then has
itself,
to be asked.
Definitely.
If
yes.
they're coping in a way that makes it worse, you see, it's a desperate act that makes things worse, but it's still coping.
Exactly.
All of these are totally meaningful acts.
Absolutely.
And then the question becomes, and I've done too many shows now where I put this out, and I have too much of this in my book. In fact, I'm going to rewrite. I'm doing a revision of the book. The first book,
right.
this book that I wrote, which I think is the best. I've written five of these already. But this is really
right.
the best one I've written. It sold 40 fucking copies.
Yeah,
in a year
yeah.
and a half.
It's
right?
crazy. Yeah.
So I'm going to write it again.
Yeah.
But it is the coping. And
exactly.
to me, if you step outside, what has happened to most of us is that we live in a kind of an authoritarian system that tells us what we've done wrong and how we're wrong, how we're somehow essentially bad or wrong or evil or crazy. And when we fight back against the system or become part of the system,
mm-hmm.
we not only become dehumanized, we dehumanize others. And now we can't do the two things you mentioned. Although I have one is not just, we have to be part of a family, we have to have friends, we can't do it alone. Evolution
yeah, well,
told
that's,
us
that's,
we can't.
That's
the
part
second
of
thing
that's
is I think
connected.
We have to create.
Yeah, be best being connected.
We have
to
create something. Yes.
Absolutely. That's it.
When we
that's
can't
so,
do that, it's because we're in a system that really tells us that's the wrong way to go. And then when we do it the wrong way, we end up being scared and end up in this fucking system that now tells us we really are worse defective than we think we are. But there's really
yeah.
nothing to be done about it because it's not just your essential self that's no good, but your brain is no good.
Right, right.
And
yeah,
now you're
tell
trapped.
Me what you mean by
they own your soul.
You tell me what you mean by the wrong thing. We're told that we're
yeah.
doing the wrong thing.
In other words, I want to create something, right? And I don't know what to do. I don't have the skill. So I do something that others judge as harmful or stupid or crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Or
mm-hmm.
I end up abusing people. See, in a hierarchical system, we have to aggrandize the people above us and believe them mm-hmm. rather than our own eyes. And then we have to have obedience from the people below us and have them aggrandize us. We're now in a trap.
Right.
How do you get out of the trap? And when you start doing things desperately, and when you start to believe you are defective, how do you cope with that? What's the right way of doing that? Or I did a lot of work in that clinic with cops who had killed people and soldiers who came back from Vietnam.
Yeah.
A soldier tells me that he killed people. He killed children. That he was a helicopter gunship. He was on a helicopter gunship, and they would fly over, swoop on a village, and when they fired at the ground, every man, woman, child, and animal became red paste.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got stoned one night, and his buddy went up to take his place, and the buddy was killed.
Mm.
And he says, who's going to forgive me? And then mm-hmm. what happened in that war, they figured out that the war was a lie. They were losing. Everybody was told that they were winning and they were losing. So he lost the justification.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, there's a horrible moral injury. Moral injury in that war.
Moral, I like the term now, moral injury. Not PTSD. It's a moral
yeah, yeah.
injury.
Exactly.
Now, how do you repair a morality that's been destroyed because you really did do those things and now can't justify it?
Yeah,
how
well,
do you deal with
of...
the shame and the guilt? Whatever
yeah,
you do
a...
really doesn't work. It
yeah.
becomes the coping, the drugs, the delusions, the craziness. They're a way of getting out of this intolerable situation, but all they end up is being seen as worse symptoms.
Exactly, and drugged, and yeah. See, there's something valuable about going through it over and over and over and over again, because maybe you get to see that you didn't have a chance. There was no, it wasn't your fault. You know, you were a tool. You were a victim.
Right.
You know, I don't know if you know the work that James Pendergast has done. James Pennerbacker in Texas. He's done this many times. What he does is he has college students. He gives them a writing assignment. And half of them are assigned to write about the most traumatic thing that's ever happened to you. And they're told to write for 30 minutes, 3 days in a row. And the other half are assigned to write about something very impersonal, like what I did last summer or where I'm going to graduate school or environmental problems, et cetera, et cetera. So half are writing about the most traumatic thing that ever happened to them, and the other half are writing about very impersonal stuff. So they actually take blood samples for 6 weeks, and they pay attention to how often they go to the clinic. Every time that's been done, Larry, every time, the ones that were writing about the most traumatic experiences have better immune function and go to the clinic less. They're healthier.
Right. And that
yeah.
doesn't surprise me, because they're working
yeah,
something through.
Exactly.
In a
that's
different
exactly
context.
Happening. And they, if you read what they write every day, so they look at what they write every day, and you can see that they're making sense out of what happened. They're
right.
integrating it into their lives.
Right.
They're making
right.
sense out of it.
Right.
And so I want to tell you, you know, what you're saying is absolutely right. And I wrote a pamphlet, and basically it's called Your Symptoms Are the Path of Mental Health, but my first title was this: all so-called symptoms are meaningful, somehow functional, and potentially useful.
Therefore,
we ought to help people learn from the symptoms.
No, I'm sorry. Therefore, they're not symptoms.
Okay, so they're not symptoms.
But you see, that's the point, Al. We got to get rid of this notion that they're symptoms. They're not
okay,
symptoms of anything.
I agree. So
they are what they are, and they're not having anything to do with medicine.
I agree.
So we're trapped.
So the only reason I'm using, I agree. So So you could say it this way. You can say everything that people experience, everything people are experiencing, no matter how painful, no matter how troubling, no matter how even dangerous, no matter how bizarre, everything they're experiencing is meaningful, somehow functional,
purposeful,
and potentially useful.
Yes.
Yeah. And everything.
Yes.
So depression is what happens when you've lost something very valuable, and you grieve. That's what happens. Depression is what happens when you have deep concerns about your life,
right?
And you need to do some work on your life. And the depression is very helpful because it says it makes you stop. It says the depression says stop living. You stop doing what you're doing. You dumb fuck. Stop doing what you're doing. Stop focusing
outside.
Yeah, but outside.
You see. That becomes
spend some
helpful.
Time with yourself,
Al. That becomes helpful when the person can say, "I'm not sick. I need to stop what I'm doing, you dumb fuck."
Yeah, exactly.
But people don't
exactly.
say that. What they
no,
say is
no, because they're told they're sick.
Right.
It's a horrible situation.
Right. So it needs a total different story or reinterpretation.
Yeah,
and the moment
exactly.
they're diagnosed, we put the nail into the coffin.
Exactly.
Purpose now is to convince the public in whatever small way I can that if they go to a psychotherapist, they come armed and they say, I want to work out a fee with you, but under no circumstances do I want to be diagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to see everything you write about me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
It dawned on me that many years ago, somebody said, you keep notes on me. Can I see them? And my first response was the typical response. Why do you want to see them?
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about this. I go into my doctor's office and the report is waiting. I don't have to ask to see it. He says, here's the report on you. It's mine.
Right.
Right. So they
need to be
armed.
Yeah.
And we have
what
to
I
stop
do.
Making diagnoses, Al, and we're not going
well,
to.
Well, you know, I agree. I agree. The diagnosis is
And we're
going to
be eaten alive.
Yeah. It's the diagnosis is useless. We don't need it. Now, you know, I diagnose everybody with adjustment disorder, and we don't talk about it. I'm
how
talking
dare
about
you?
Their lives. When they
no,
come
no,
in,
how dare you?
What's going on?
How dare you or I say disorder? I used to use adjustment disorder.
Yeah.
Because it's so, but it's called a disorder. Who's disordered?
Yeah. It's bullshit.
What does it mean,
Al,
to be disordered?
Yeah, right. Larry, why
do I
do it?
You see where we are? I hope I'm not, you know, to see me as being hostile in any way.
No. I hear
you. We have to find a way of stopping this.
Well,
and extricating. See, I believe psychotherapy. And I've never been able to find a good word for it. All I do is put it in quotes, which is okay if it's written. But when I say psychotherapy, I can't say psychotherapy with therapy in quotes. It's cumbersome and it has no meaning. So when you're involved in this, it needs another piece of language. So we've created, since the Enlightenment, a new kind of relationship. It's not parent-child. It's not attorney-client. It's not teacher-student. It's not doctor-patient. It's not.
Right.
So we need to define it in a certain way, and people have to be able and educated to not ever allow themselves to get entangled in this horrendous, horrendous system.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen.
Someday it's going to happen, or something better. There's going to be something much better happen. And the reason I say that is because human beings can't be fooled for that long. You know, I don't know if you've, you know,
let's
I talk
watch
about.
The next, let's watch this election, Al.
Okay, but Larry, let me tell you, I think about women's suffrage, right? How long does it take human beings to get it? With a no-brainer, with a total no-brainer like women's suffrage. So the first bill calling for women's suffrage was introduced into the United States Congress in 1870. Larry, 1870.
Right.
And they had been talking about it for 20 years before that.
Right.
You know, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and all those since 1850. So we're talking about it took 70 years for that no-brainer to happen.
Why did it happen? Why did it happen?
Oh, finally, I think the reason that – I don't know, actually, Larry. It's a great question. I think I
would
say –
Did it have leaders? Did it have people who came out and spoke the truth? Did they go
absolutely.
Public?
Years and
Did
years.
Did they take their lumps?
Yes. Years
so
and years.
So when are we going to speak out, and when are we going to take our lumps? And not you,
That's
me,
what you're doing.
You.
That's what
well,
you're
I
doing
am
it.
Because, you see, I have nothing to lose anymore.
Yeah, you're doing it. You know, I do it.
I am.
I'm doing it right now with you.
You are. You
yeah.
are. And I got to get somebody on every day, every other day, to do this with me again and tell their friends to listen. Right?
Yeah.
Because
so let me tell you the most
unless
horrible,
there really is a public set of ideas laid out that people can really get their head around, you see, it's not going to change.
No, that's right.
And
that's
the
exactly right.
I watch the ad. Do I have to show you the advertising on television? Billions and billions of dollars.
Oh yeah, it's horrible.
It's
so you know Mickey Weinberg, right? You know Mickey Weinberg.
Yes.
You know
sure
Mickey Weinberg. You know Mickey was on the board of Mind Freedom, and in 2003,
they did the fast,
the hunger strike. They did the fast.
Yeah, the
freedom.
Hunger strike. Yeah, yeah.
Hunger strike. Which, you know, the reason. Let me tell you his reason for doing it. This is the reason that Mickey Weinberg did that. He wanted to give the general public a message that psychiatry is founded on a bunch of bullshit. He
right.
wanted to give the general public the message: there's no scientific foundation underneath psychiatry.
Yes,
and he wanted to create skepticism, and he wanted
yes.
to put a dent in the armor of the authority of psychiatry.
Yes.
So he's going to do it again now, but this time they're going to do it with mental health professionals, quote unquote.
Absolutely, that was the problem originally.
Yeah, back
what
in
happened
2003,
is that there were patients
survivors.
Who were involved.
Right.
And
exactly.
the only reason the patients would do this, the public reasoned, and the doctors attacked them, was that because they were mentally ill.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it worked. I mean, it really worked because the American Psychiatric Association sent a textbook saying this is proof. And we had a scientific panel with David Cohen and Peter Bregan and
right.
and David Healy and Joanna Moncrief. And they just debunked it, you know, debunked it using the same stuff, other stuff in the same textbook. So he's doing it again, but this time with mental health professionals. So this all that we're doing is the same thing that the women's suffragettes were doing over those 70 years.
Right.
We're doing the same thing. We're doing the same thing the Soviet dissidents were doing. Listen, people knew in 1930 that the Soviet experiment was not going to work. So you had all the dissidents. You had people talking in their living rooms. This is fucked up. This isn't going to work. You had the gulag. You had the – finally it comes down. It takes 50 years. All of a sudden, it seems like it comes down all of a sudden. Yeah, no.
And now they have Putin.
And now they have Putin.
And we have Trump.
And we have Trump. So let me tell you one thing. One more thing I want to tell you, Larry.
Give me a reason to be optimistic.
Well, here's the reason. The reason is we're doing what the suffragettes were doing. We're doing what the dissidents were doing. It takes years and years and years and years and years.
Okay.
And there's a guy named Morris Berman who wrote a book. It's a great book called The Twilight of American Culture. He says the American culture is dying. I'll give you four criteria for a dying culture. Increasing inequalities of wealth and income, first criteria. Second criteria, decreasing returns from investment in technology. And you could look at the fact that we spend $700 billion a year on the war machine. As exactly that. $700 billion, and what do we get for it? Bullshit, nothing. Then the third thing was the dumbing down of Americans and the loss of spirituality. He says, "So what do you do when you're enlightened and your culture is going to shit? What you do is you do the same thing the scribes did, the monks during the Dark Ages. What they did was write all of the, where they wrote down all of the work of the Greek philosophers and the Greek thinkers. They kept them alive, and that's what
right.
you do. You keep on telling the truth. You keep on speaking the truth, and that's what we're
I'm
doing.
I'm with you, Al. I'm totally with you, except my fears are not merely about this, but there's a shit, you know, this pandemic is a shitstorm, but it's nothing
yeah.
compared to what's now on us in terms of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing.
Yeah.
That has to be addressed.
Oh, yeah.
And it has to be addressed in a very big way with enormous changes in how people live. And
yeah.
and so I'm going to do, and you're going to do what we're doing in terms of getting the word out as best we can about the bullshit of Big Pharma and the bullshit of psychiatry and the bullshit
mm-hmm.
of all of us every time we make a diagnosis of adjustment disorder or anything else. Because it is bullshit, it's destructive, and
oh, yeah.
we're doing it so that we can earn a living, and there's nothing wrong in earning a living. But we got to find a different, well, not say we. I keep saying we because I really don't want to ever admit how out of it I am. I just let my license go. I don't
yeah.
want to see people at
yeah.
night anymore. I just don't do it. I do this and my writing for whatever that effect that will have.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to, it's going to be a slog, and I hope we have the time to do it. Because
yeah.
what's going
well,
to happen, our military already has plans for how to handle the massive population that has to start moving when parts of the United States can't be lived in anymore.
Right. Yeah, see, and I'm not even as aware of that as I should be, but I know it's a big problem. And I know we're
all over the
change.
World. There are places
yeah,
in the world
change.
That no longer can be in somewhere in Asia, near the equator
yeah.
last summer, the temperature went to 167 degrees.
Holy shit. Really
and nobody
amazing.
Could live more than an hour if they left their house.
Yeah, yeah.
It was
yeah.
130 in Paris this year. It was 130 yeah. in Los Angeles. And they were all on fire.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely, it's happening. So let me go back. Let me do two things. Go back to what we were talking about. What about soul healing? You know, psychotherapy, that's what it really means. Psyche is soul, and therapy is heal. What about soul healing, soul healers? Or soul teachers, or soul something.
As the word, you mean?
Yeah, as a word,
yeah. You know, I believe in the word soul as in a secular way, though. And
yeah.
so, to me, the word soul takes on too much of a religious meaning. And ultimately, when I do my show tomorrow, I'm going to talk about the reason the earth crapped out was because we created this hierarchy with a man in the sky. And that we have a soul that's immortal. And therefore, we can't face the fact that when we die, we die. And we do all kinds of... Talk about trying to do something in a situation that only makes it worse. Let's all
delusion.
Be obedient to the man in the sky or the people who talk for him so we can all go to the great golf course in the sky for eternity.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's amazing, isn't it?
Yes.
Talk about a mass delusion. Talk about a mass delusion. Yeah, that's a mass delusion.
Right.
Yeah.
And,
so
and because it's a
thing.
Mass delusion, you can't call it schizophrenia.
That's right.
Well, that's the criteria,
mass,
by the way.
There's such a thing as mass psychosis, though, you know.
Yeah, I know.
So we're talking about, let me tell you the group of people that's most harmed and the most horrible thing we do. This is absolutely the most horrible thing that the mental health system does. Okay, Larry? You take a person who's been really hurt badly, okay? I mean, you take a person who's been hurt so badly, who has been discounted to such an extent, made to feel so inadequate, abused, mm-hmm. neglected, put down, rejected so badly that they create their own reality.
Right.
They are so terrified
Right.
They're
but
so
that's what I meant. That's the adaptation.
Yeah, exactly. They're so terrified of the world and of human beings that they create their own reality. They find a way to protect themselves. And, see, there's a guy named John Weir Perry who spent a lot of time with people diagnosed with schizophrenia that really got to know them. And he says, here's what's happening, folks. These people have been hurt so badly, and they have such a feeling of powerlessness that their psyche, their psychic energy attaches to a part of themselves that's more powerful. And he was a Jungian, so their psychic energy attaches to a part of themselves that's like the king, the magician, the warrior. It attaches to a part of themselves that's deeper in the psyche. And that's where its energy goes. And so the energy is not there in the rational, in the neocortex, you want to call it, or the rational side. And this is a move towards healing. John Weir Perry sees this. This is a move towards healing.
You see, it doesn't work.
You know what he called it? He called it a reconstitution of the self.
Right.
And he said,
the problem is that the reconstitution of the self can't be successful if it's a delusion.
Exactly.
It has to be able to end up in real love and real creativity.
Yes, exactly. Well, this is what the Soteri House did. The Soteri House, you come out and say, come on in. You can stay here as long as you want.
Right.
We're not going to put pressure on you to get better. We're not going to put pressure on you to go back the way you were.
Right.
We're going to help you go through this experience.
Right. So that's where it has to go. A lot of Soteri houses.
Exactly. And so what we do, I mean, this is the worst fucking thing I can imagine. So here's a person that has moved towards healing. They've made a move towards healing, not a choice, not an intentional choice, the way that we use the word choice, but some part of them, some deep, healthy part of them has made a move in the right direction. And we stop it. We give them a fucking antipsychotic drug that stops the process, and we tell them you have a brain disease, and you're going to have to take this for the rest of your life. And we turn them into chronically mentally ill people. That is the worst fucking crime I can imagine.
It's a crime against humanity.
Oh, it's a horrible crime.
And it has
to stop.
It happens
every day.
And it has to stop. And you and I, because we know this, have to do whatever we can within our ability to stop it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's horrible. It is so horrible.
Right.
And it's more horrible than
I
can even say. And if you tell people about it, they'll think you're crazy. If you say, what are you telling me? You tell me that a person with psychosis is a move towards healing? You're out of your fucking mind. And they're wrong.
You know
they're
the story of Thomas Szasz?
Yeah.
When Thomas Szasz wrote The Myth of Mental Illness, they came after him. They tried to take his license away, which they failed to do, but he was a professor at Upstate University in New York. They got him fired.
Yeah.
The
mm-hmm.
only person in the entire faculty who stood up to him was, what's his name? You know, I can't remember
Ron
any
Leifer.
Names anymore.
Ron Leifer.
No.
Ron Leifer.
No, the guy who wrote the about death, won the 1974 Pulitzer Prize. Now I can't even remember the name of the book. The Denial of Death.
The which?
The Denial of Death. It's a reworking of psychoanalytic theory where sex isn't the problem, but our fear of death is the problem. It's psychoanalysis.
Denial of
death. And it won the 1974 Pulitzer Prize. He stood up for him.
Oh, yeah. Well, Ron Leifer did also. He was a fellow professor, I think.
Was he? I have to look that up because that's interesting. Because I only thought it was one. But most of the faculty let him go.
Oh yeah,
they denied his took his tenure away and they fired him. I mean, it was just really.
Oh yeah, well, you know what's happening now in academic psychology programs?
Yes,
you have to have neuroscientists.
Yeah, the American Psychological Association says diagnoses now must be made only with behavioral behaviors. Describing behavior. So I have a granddaughter, fabulous young lady, who's just started her PhD in school psych in Fordham University. And she called me. She said, Papa, what's going on? So I sent her a paper I submitted to EHPP. I can't get her to read my book. Eventually, I'll get pissed enough at her. I say, you got to read my book. But no, but she's really busy now. So I sent her the paper I submitted. You know, we had that call for papers.
Yeah, right.
No one's written one but me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm going to tell Jacqueline Sparks, I'm going to give it another month. If they can't publish the damn thing as a single, I'm going to post it on the internet and post it at EHPP. Let people read it for whatever they want to. But you know, it's calling for people to do what we're doing on the phone right now, which
right.
is work out a system that frees the field economically, intellectually, and morally from this bullshit.
Yeah. No, I think fundamentally exactly what you know and see is what people have to come to see, that all of these experiences, these states of beings, these behaviors, they're all functional. They're all what people are doing to live their lives the best they can.
Yes, the best they can under
they
the totals, as I wrote, it's the best they can under the total circumstances of their lives. Physically,
exactly.
Biologically, socially, economically, politically.
Yeah, and
it's
exactly, and it
do.
Is a problem. You know, another part of this problem, and you know, Michael Ventura and James Hillman wrote a book called "We've Had 100 Years of Psychotherapy, and the World Isn't Any Better Off."
Right,
and their whole
it's certainly not mentally healthy yet. Anyway,
Al, thank you.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Well, their point was, you know, what we're doing is helping people adjust. We're helping people adjust to a sick society.
Yes.
And one of the horrible things about the medical model and convincing people they're sick is that then we don't have to deal with the social problems that are causing the sickness.
It's political.
Right?
It's a political act.
It's a way of avoiding it.
But it's also a political act.
Yes, it's a political act.
It silences dissent.
Silences dissent.
Silences.
Yeah.
You can't protest.
Science is the same word about that.
Well, if somebody, when you or I are called mentally ill for saying what we're saying, it's a political act to silence us. Shut us up.
Silence. Oh, yeah. To silence us.
Not
yes.
science.
Yes.
Silence. There's no science.
Yeah, silence.
Anyway, I'm going to hang on you. I'm going to close the show. I got to turn on and see what Nicole Wallace has to tell me about what outrages and abuses have taken place in the United States. I see that the market has now started to fall again. Fell 500 points today.
Wow. So, this is going to happen.
Yes. And while I don't want to see any of my money go down the tubes, that'll be another nail in he who must not be named's coffin.
Exactly. You know, and I'm finally going to play the market the right way. When it goes down, I'm going to buy something. I've never done it right. I've lost so much fucking money in the stock market, you can't believe it.
Well, you know what I did?
Anyway.
2008, when the market crashed, I took most of my money and put it into a fixed account.
Uh-huh.
Had I not, I would have three times the amount of money, at least, that I have. However, I have never lost a wink of sleep worrying about the market since then.
Right.
And it left
right.
me enough in my pension to live out my life and maybe even leave the kids a couple of bucks when I go.
That's great.
But I couldn't.
That's great.
I couldn't. It's like playing betting on the horses.
Yeah. Well, except for people who know what they're doing, they can do it. You know,
and
they
I
really
certainly
can.
Never did.
I never did. So, Larry, I'm really glad you do this show. It's terrific. And what you're doing is exactly what – it's the same as the suffragettes did.
That's a nice thing to hear. I want to thank you for coming on.
You're welcome. You're so welcome. I love
And not
talk.
Only
are
my thank you, but we're going to do this again in the not-too-distant future.
Oh, I'd love to do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Give me
because
a call.
I had Chuck Ruby on. I did a show with him a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
Before his
right.
book came out, we did a show on smoke and mirrors.
Right.
And then we did one on what is the self. I was on the phone with him. We were ruminating, and we did the show, and it's a terrific, terrific discussion. He's fabulous, by the way. I think Chuck Ruby is in a class by himself. But he's becoming overwhelmed by the fact that he's doing everything himself in the organization.
Yeah, I know that's a problem. I brought him to ISEP. I met him on the Division 32 listserv.
Yeah. He may punch you in the nose for that someday.
Yeah.
You may lose a friend over that.
Yeah, no, we have to help him more somehow or other. We do.
Yeah, I do. I try. Anyway, thank you for being here. Dr. Al.
You're welcome, Larry.
Take care.
Yeah.
And,
so you were the first member of ISEP I ever talked to. In 2003,
right.
I called you up, and you told me how to go to and you know who I met? I met at that conference in New Jersey, the most wonderful guy in ISEP.
Who?
There's a bunch of wonderful guys. Andrew Levine. What a prince.
Oh, I
Andrew
love him,
Levine. What a great guy.
I'll tell you a story about how I got thrown out of ICEP, ICSPP.
No,
I started
you
having
thrown out. You and Lou Wynn got fed up with it.
No, no, I picked what happened. I was having an online fight with Bob Whitaker. Robert Strickland.
Yeah.
And one night I was going on, and I had a couple of drinks, and I said nasty things to him.
Oh,
and
wow.
The next thing I know, Andy Levine calls me. You've been thrown off the with listserv.
Wow.
I said, listen, you threw me off without even talking to me?
I didn't realize that.
That happened. So I called up. Dominic Riccio, with whom I was. I thought we were really close. He said, "Okay, I'll put you back on." I said, "How did you let that happen?" Over the years, I have been trying to apologize for what I said to Slicklin. I mean, stupid things. You know, nothing really harmful, but stupid things. When you get drunk and angry. And finally, this year, I got in contact with him, and I apologized. And he said, "Yeah, I just took it as your acerbic sense of humor. I wasn't offended." But anyway, that was the story.
He's a great guy. Robert Strickland's a great guy. Okay.
And by the way, everybody I know there is a good guy. But what happens is
everybody I know there is a good guy.
I can't get them to come on and say what you said with me today.
Well, that's interesting. Well, they're not egomaniacs like me. I'm an egomaniac.
No, you're not. You just have courage. It's called having some balls. Take care.
Okay. Larry, take
care,
man. What you're doing is good. It's good stuff. Okay. Bye.